This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik Studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, following the truck attack in Nice, France last week, we examine two dimensions of U.S. policy aimed at combating the threat of terrorism.
That's right. First, an interview with the ACLU's Cade Crockford on the government's use of surveillance technology at home.
And then later, we speak with activist and author David Swanson about the Pentagon's crusade against terrorist networks abroad.
But first, let's start off with politics here in the U.S.,
which,
during times like this, can turn particularly toxic. You know, Donald Trump officially announced his pick for vice president, Indiana Governor Mike Pence. He did that on Friday last week, but not before a feverish attempt by some of the other rumored VP choices to nab the position by exploiting the attacks in France to say some really, really retrograde, awful stuff about Muslims.
And now, just to clarify, this was during a rather chaotic news day, as it was called, when Trump... Rumors had it that Trump was going to pick Pence, and then the campaign wouldn't confirm it immediately, and it was...
Right. So there was this limbo we saw these guys come out of the woodwork here. First, before I get into it, we have Newt Gingrich, and this was a pathetic attempt. It was like, wait, Mr. Trump, have you heard just how Islamophobic I can be before picking your VP? Here was Trump on Fox News late last week, mind you. This was before we had any idea on the motivation of the attacker in France or anything.
Let me be as blunt and as direct as I can be. Western civilization is in a war. We should, frankly, test every person from here who is of a Muslim background, and if they believe in Sharia, they should be deported.
There you go.
That's not a dog whistle. That's a foghorn.
Yes.
In fact, those are cathedral bells trying to drum up support for a crusade.
Yes, I couldn't have put it better. Trump, you know, proposes his Muslim ban last year. Now we've got Gingrich trying to get in under the wire here with his Muslim testing regimen. He went further, too. He didn't just stop there. In fact, he said that certain types of research and journalism and just human curiosity could be punished by a felony, proposing that just the act of visiting an extremist website, that should be against the law.
Anybody who goes on a website favoring ISIS or Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, that should be a felony and they should go to jail. Any organization which hosts such a website should be engaged in a felony. It should be closed down immediately.
That's appalling, but I was also struck by his correct pronunciation of Al-Qaeda.
Well, broken clock. We're going to dive deeper into what Gingrich said right there with Cade a little bit later in the show, but let me just say a few things. Think about what Gingrich is proposing here. Imagine if you're a journalist that's covering the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. Your job is to visit these websites to figure out how these organizations are thinking, what their motivations are. Gingrich wants to make that a felony. What if you're a researcher?
It's astonishing. It's shockingly reckless.
What if you're just a curious citizen who wants to know what is motivating the Islamic State, why they hate us?
Right. Or what if you're scared of, you know, what they're doing, which is truly awful, and therefore you want to learn about it to educate yourself for whatever reason?
Right.
You're a felon, according to Newt Gingrich.
Yes, this is particularly problematic stuff. But Gingrich wasn't the only one hoping to get Trump's attention late last week before he picked his VP. So too was retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Flynn was another guy who was on Trump's vice presidential shortlist. And almost immediately following the attacks last week, again, before anyone really knew anything about who the perpetrator was and why they did it, General Flynn took to Twitter to say, quote, "In the next 24 hours, I dare Arab and Persian world leaders, in air quotes, to step up to the plate and declare their Islamic ideology sick and must be healed." Of course, this is that tired old mantra here that it's up to moderate Muslims to condemn their religion, even though these attacks have about as much to do with Islam as the Planned Parenthood shooter was a product of Christianity. There's nothing Islamic about what the Islamic State is doing or what Al-Qaeda was doing.
Yeah.
They want you to believe that they're Muslims, and yet so many people here in the U.S. are willing to just buy it.
Well, look, I mean, you know, they represent a brand of Islam that's really perverted and really messed up. You know, they identify as Muslims. There's no denying that. But, you know, to say that they represent 1.7 billion people on Earth is really...
Well, luckily, those last-ditch Islamophobic efforts didn't work. Trump stuck with Pence as his veep, who, by the way, wasn't that much better on Twitter. He described the attacks in Paris as being perpetrated by people who are at war with Western civilization, similar to what Gingrich said, which, again, is exactly what these terrorist organizations want us to believe, that it's a war between them and Western civilization. It elevates their cause when we shouldn't be elevating their cause.
Yeah. You know, there was an aspect to this story that really, really wound me up, really, really grinded my gears, as Peter Griffin might say. The reaction of Bill Kristol, the neocon, the intellectual fraud, and editor of the Dookie Rag Weekly Standard, he reacted to Newt's proposal with the following tweet. Curious, is Newt proposing Congress enact unconstitutional law, or that President act unconstitutionally on his own? That might be a good question to ask if the person who asked it was anyone but Bill Kristol, who was a fervent supporter of all things George W. Bush, what he did on national security. Just one example that took me like, literally it took me like 15 seconds to find on Google after I saw this tweet. In 2005, Kristol co-wrote an op-ed about Bush's warrantless wiretapping. Its title was, quote, "Vital Presidential Power." Here is how it starts out. Just going to read the first paragraph. A U.S. president has just received word that American counter-terrorist operations have captured a senior al-Qaeda operative in Pakistan. Among his possessions are a couple of cell phones, phones that contain several American phone numbers. In the wake of September 11th, 2001, what's a president to do? So spare me your concerns about constitutionality and Islamophobia. Bill Kristol, you blubbering hack. Causing myself to sputter here.
You know what reminds me of? What if we found a laptop of doom, though? Remember the laptop of doom story that was pushed by Eli Lake and the rest of those, that U.S. operatives had found in an al-Qaeda stash a laptop of doom that contained all this information?
Yeah, then what do we do?
Yeah. Speaking of terrorism, another story that broke at the end of last week, the release of the 28 pages, finally. We've been beating this drum for a while.
Yeah.
Actually, there are 29 pages if you include the cover page of the report.
You know, we're just going to stick with 28.
We'll stick with 28?
28. Let's stick with it.
Well, I've had a chance to read through a lot of these 28 pages, and I highlighted some passages here that seem particularly interesting. And I have the report right here, the newly declassified report. Come get me, James Comey. Come get me. And I just, this is the very first sentence of this report here. The very first sentence, it says, findings. While in the United States, some of the September 11th hijackers were in contact with and received support or assistance from individuals who may be connected to the Saudi government, there is information, primarily from FBI sources, that at least two of those individuals were alleged by some to be Saudi intelligence officers. So we just dive right into it here with findings that two people, at least two, were likely Saudi intelligence officers who had contact with the 9/11 hijackers. There's a lot of redacted elements, too, here in this report. So it's not a full airing of the 28 pages. Lots of black ink spilled still. Including, it talks about how the FBI's Washington field office created a squad devoted to, and this is in the context of studying Saudi involvement in terrorism in the U.S., we don't know what it's devoted to. It's completely redacted.
Oh, man.
Another interesting thing here is it says that only recently, and only as a result of this joint inquiry, the congressional inquiry here, did the FBI and the CIA establish a working group to address the Saudi issue. It wasn't even on their radar that Saudi Arabia could be financing terrorism or could be associated with certain
Saudi
individuals.
This was only
here in the
after
US.
The 9/11 commission.
Right.
Correct.
Right. And the inquiry here says, in the view of this joint inquiry, this gap in U.S. intelligence coverage is unacceptable, given the magnitude and immediacy of the potential risks to U.S. national security. The intelligence community needs to address this area of concern as aggressively and as quickly as possible. Like, hey guys, why weren't you paying attention to this? Pay attention to it now. Now, the FBI community, the law enforcement community here responds and says one reason for the limited understanding is that it was only after September 11th that the U.S. government began to aggressively investigate this issue of Saudi involvement. Prior to September 11th, the FBI apparently did not focus investigative resources on redacted Saudi nationals in the United States due to Saudi Arabia's status as an American ally. So since they were an ally, we weren't connecting the dots. We didn't think that anything could possibly happen here.
I think that may have been what Steve Cohen was referring to in his testimony. Yeah, we're addicted to oil. That's why they're not on the terror list.
This report goes on to specifically name individuals that had contact with the hijackers and were also likely affiliated with the Saudi government. One, Omar al-Bayoumi. The FBI had received numerous reports from individuals in the Muslim community dating back to 1999 alleging that al-Bayoumi may be a Saudi intelligence officer, the report reads. FBI files suggest that al-Bayoumi provided substantial assistance to hijackers Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi after they arrived in San Diego in February 2000.
Can I just stop you for a second? You said that tip that came, it came in 1996 about
yes.
al-Bayoumi, and it
yes.
came from the Muslim community, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. FBI received numerous reports from individuals in the Muslim community, which this stuff is often lost. There's General Flynn here talking about, you know, as we said, he's asked Muslims to step up.
Yeah.
Muslims are the people who are giving us the information here.
You know, and just briefly, you know, I had people sort of approach me as a lefty progressive after the Paris attacks, after big terrorist attacks, say, you know, what will you do? You talk bad about surveillance, counterterrorism, et cetera. I think the best piece of intelligence generally is human intelligence, and people will not cooperate with the government if, you know, they don't trust the government.
True.
If the government sends informants into their communities, if the government wiretaps them with only subpoenas or without warrants, et cetera, go on. So I just wanted to...
That's a good point.
...to highlight that.
Here's more information here about al-Bayoumi, who had contact with two of the hijackers. During the same time frame that he was contacted with the hijackers, al-Bayoumi had extensive contact with Saudi government establishments in the United States and received financial support from a Saudi company affiliated with the Saudi Ministry of Defense. In fact, that financial support increased substantially in April 2000, 2 months after the hijackers arrived in San Diego. That's a little strange. Another guy mentioned here in the report, Osama Bosman, he lived across the street from the hijackers, and he made a comment to an FBI asset that he did more than al-Bayoumi did for the hijackers. According to a CIA memo, Bosman reportedly received funding and possibly a fake passport from Saudi government officials. He and his wife have received financial support from the Saudi ambassador to the United States and his wife. And a CIA report also indicates that Bosman traveled to Houston in 2002 and met with an individual who was redacted. I don't know who he met with.
This is in 2002?
Yes. Not sure who he met with. Another person here mentioned Saleh al-Hussein, September 2001. Hussein, reportedly a Saudi interior ministry official, stayed at the same hotel in Herndon, Virginia, where al-Hazmi was staying, one of the hijackers. And then there's this. Abu Zubaydah, a senior al-Qaeda operative, he was captured in Pakistan in March 2002. He could be linked, reading from the report here, at least indirectly, to telephone numbers in the United States. One of those U.S. phone numbers is subscribed to the Aspcall Corporation, which is located in Aspen, Colorado, and it manages the affairs of the Colorado residents of the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar.
Mm.
Another number linked between Zubaydah and the U.S. belonged to a bodyguard at the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. Here's one last interesting story I want to read. This is from the report, and it says that the FBI suspects, this is another individual, Mohammed al-Kudahin, of running basically a dry run in 1999 of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He notes, al-Kudahin was involved in a 1999 incident aboard the America West flight, which the FBI's Phoenix office now suspects may have been a dry run to test airline security. During the flight, Kudahin and his associate asked the flight attendants a variety of suspicious questions. Al-Kudahin then attempted to enter the cockpit on two occasions. Here's the kicker. Kudaheen and his associate were flying to Washington, D.C. to attend a party at the Saudi embassy, and both claimed that their tickets were paid for by the Saudi embassy. So look, there is a lot of information here. I've got even more stuff highlighted here, but I don't want to just keep reading off the report.
Right,
everybody
right.
can go online and read the report for themselves now that it's out there.
Just a quick reminder, too, that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals.
Exactly, exactly. And we were told leading up to the release of this report by the CIA, by the White House, that this was all uncorroborated, unvetted information, that we shouldn't pay any attention to it. And look, I've taken one glance at it here, and there's a lot of stuff I want to keep reading and keep investigating there, and hopefully others do too. We've got just a little bit of time here left in this block, and I want to make a correction. Last week, Sam and I did a huge rant about Tim Tebow speaking at the RNC. Sam called him a big loser. I objected to that, noting that Tim Tebow, any time he's had a chance to start on a football team, he actually wins games. He's not a loser.
Yeah, sure. Question the NFL coaches who think he's a
And just to prove my point that he's not a loser, he's not speaking at the RNC. After the Trump campaign unveiled his name, Tebow released a Facebook video saying, "I woke up this morning to find out I was speaking at the Republican National Convention. It's amazing how fast rumors fly." And that's exactly what it is, a rumor. RNC chief spokesman Sean Spicer confirmed that Tebow would indeed not be speaking at the RNC. He said, quote, "I think that we would love to have him. Don't get me wrong. There was some speculation that he might be coming. I think he's cleared that up." And I think that's a wise move by Tebow. Don't you?
I don't care.
More unanimous dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C. Take it away, Sam.
So last week, as we mentioned on the show, a federal court in Manhattan delivered a setback to the surveillance state. Judge William Pauley ruled that the Drug Enforcement Agency violated the Constitution by using a cell site simulator, bit of a tongue twister, without a warrant. The devices, also known as stingrays, are used by cops to track a target by imitating cell phone towers and pinging mobile phones within a range. In some cases, they are mounted on airplanes and flown over entire communities, collecting sensitive information about innocent people in the process. In the wake of Thursday's attack in Nice, and in the context of the general counterterror hysteria in the U.S., the use of cell site simulation and the wider surveillance state deserve heightened scrutiny. And we intend on giving it that today by bringing on a privacy expert, a veritable civil liberties god among mortals, Cade Crockford, who is the Director of Technology and Liberty Program at the ACLU of Massachusetts, and a very prolific Twitter account at @1_Cade. Cade's joining us to chat about our constant slow motion sprint towards authoritarianism. Cade, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So I want to talk more about Judge Pauley's ruling, or talk about Judge Pauley's ruling. What did he say exactly, and what do you think the outcome will be?
It's a great ruling, in part because of the facts. Sometimes, well, there's an old saying that bad facts make bad law. Well, not in this case. What happened in this case was in 2015, the Drug Enforcement Administration was tracking some phones and apparently discovered that there was some drug activity connected to a particular cell phone. And so they obtained a warrant to demand both call records, so that's to say which numbers the phone had dialed and which numbers the phone had received calls from, as well as what's called cell site location information, historical records showing where the cell phone had physically traveled.
Yeah.
And so the phone company disclosed this information to the DEA, and the DEA discovered that the phone probably lived somewhere in the vicinity of 177th Street and Broadway in Washington Heights, New York City, but that was as precise as the cell site location information could get them. So they still couldn't figure out who this person was or where they lived. So based on this information, the DEA sent a technician out to Washington Heights with a stingray and programmed the IMSI number, the International Mobile Subscriber Identification Number of the particular cell phone, into the stingray and hunted for this person and their phone. And they found him. They found the stingray identified building, and then the guy went inside the building and walked along the halls until he found the actual door, the apartment door, where this cell phone was likely residing behind. So he went back to his DEA office and told his colleagues, "I think I found the phone." Those guys went back later that night, knocked on the door. This guy, Raymond Lambus, who's the defendant in this case, his father answered the door, let them into the apartment, said, "Sure, you can come inside." Raymond Lambus then said, "Sure, you can search my room." The agents found a bunch of drugs, narcotics, drug paraphernalia, you know, plastic bags, a scale, indication that he was selling drugs, arrested him, charged him with drug distribution, and his attorneys challenged the evidence. They wanted a court to rule that evidence inadmissible because of the fact that the DEA deployed a stingray without getting a warrant, even though the DEA had obtained a warrant to get the CSLI, the historical cell site location information, showing which neighborhood Lambus lived in.
Yeah.
And even though Lambus's father let them into the apartment and Lambus allowed them to search his room. So it's a really great decision, because I think some judges might have said, "Well, look, you lost your right to privacy as soon as you let this DEA official inside your house and let him search your room." This court said, "No, absolutely not. This defense attorney is right. You never would have found his apartment had you not used the stingray, and you clearly had probable cause because you got warrants to obtain the CSLI and the call records. You should have gone back to get another warrant if you wanted to use the stingray. You didn't. Therefore, the evidence is inadmissible."
The judge also said that the DEA and the Department of Justice should have already known this, considering that they changed their guidelines about 2 months after this incident took place. This warrantless use of the stingray took place. They changed their guidelines to require that any time Department of Justice agencies use stingrays in the future, they have to get a warrant, except for certain exigent or exceptional circumstances that members of Congress have taken exception with. But those standards only applied to federal agents. They don't apply to local cops, who we know are also using stingrays. So is there a chance that this ruling, I would assume that this ruling would also apply to future cases in which local police use stingrays without a warrant? Is that correct?
Well, what we really need is an appellate court ruling on this issue. So it's not clear whether or not the prosecutors are going to appeal this district court ruling in New York, but if they do and it goes up to the circuit level, there's a huge opportunity for a significant step forward in terms of privacy protections, not just for New Yorkers, but for people within the Second Circuit who would also receive those privacy protections if a ruling is handed down at the appellate level that confirms this lower level ruling that warrants are required for stingray surveillance. And yes, if that were to happen, then state and local law enforcement would also be bound by that federal court ruling.
How do you feel about the evolution of this story? It was just a few years ago that, for the most part, we didn't know how stingrays were used by law enforcement or to the extent that they were used. Then we saw some reporting on it. There were documents revealed that the FBI even had non-disclosure agreements with local police offices that prevented them from even talking about the stingray to journalists or anybody, or even revealing their existence in courts beyond what the evidence they gleaned from them. To now the point where we have the FBI last year, the Department of Justice last year, and the Department of Homeland Security issuing these new guidelines on how they can be used, to now we have courts cracking down on them, saying you need to use warrants to use stingrays. Does that make you feel good as a privacy activist and technologist who's been following this issue for a while?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings, honestly, because on the one hand, this is a vindication of what civil libertarians have been saying for a long time, which is that the requirements of the Fourth Amendment clearly stipulate that the government needs to get a warrant to use this kind of invasive surveillance technology. On the other hand, it's pretty frustrating because law enforcement has been using this technology for many years. Decades, the FBI has been using it. Local law enforcement, at least since 2008, probably earlier than that. And for a long time, up until a couple of years ago, they were using this technology completely in secret, which meant that defense attorneys, even sometimes prosecutors, were not informed when information collected through these devices was used to build a criminal case against someone. And that's illegal. That's a violation of due process rights. So the FBI, like you said, has been forcing police departments to sign these non-disclosure agreements when they get stingrays. And the effect of that, and in my view, the intent also, is to shield the technology from precisely the kind of constitutional challenge that we have just seen vindicated in New York. This is exactly what Jim Comey was worried about when he said, we can't talk too much about this technology because we don't want the bad guys to know that it exists. That is frankly BS. The real reason that Jim Comey does not want to talk about surveillance methods and technologies is because he doesn't want pesky defense attorneys and organizations like the ACLU to be able to file these kinds of constitutional challenges in court that would require that FBI agents and DEA agents get warrants if they want to use evidence gleaned from these technologies in criminal prosecutions, as opposed to the regulations that you mentioned before that the DOJ handed down, which do not carry the force of law. There are a bunch of exemptions in those regulations, and they're not law. So, you know, FBI agents might be violating internal DOJ policy if they use a stingray without a warrant, but they're not violating the law. And so that's why transparency on these issues is absolutely critical. If we don't know what the government is doing, there's clearly no way to challenge that activity, and therefore that's how you get decades of unconstitutional surveillance without any kind of opportunity for a challenge like this.
I mean, the idea that this has to be opaque because otherwise the bad guys, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes, the bad guys will figure it out is pretty laughable. I mean, bad guys and also basically everyone over the age of 12 knows that the government has very intense surveillance policies. I mean, like, my mom used to, not to bring my mom to this, my mom used to joke about, or not joke, tell me not to joke about being on the phone saying you want to kill the president because you never know if FBI agents are going to like knock on your door. So, I mean, yeah, the idea that people need, that surveillance technology needs to be secret to stop bad guys from doing bad things is laughable.
Just listen to Sam Knight's mom.
But I want
right.
I wonder,
right. And it doesn't frankly matter to a criminal defendant how the government obtained their cell phone records, right? And people know that the government can spy on our communications and our movements through our cell phones. Like you said, that is not news.
Right. So I wanted to talk about the judiciary here and the stingrays a little more. The Supreme Court just basically made a pretty big exception to the Fourth Amendment, ruling that basically cops can detain you without cause, without probable cause, to look for an arrest warrant. If I understand the case correctly, and Sonia Sotomayor's dissent, that's what it was about. Do you really want this Supreme Court to rule on this? I mean, as a privacy advocate?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't want to speculate about what the court would or wouldn't do. Certainly, that Streif ruling was really horrific and will set us back a long time in terms of basic constitutional rights, particularly as Justice Sotomayor noted, for Black and brown people who are routinely terrorized by the police across the United States just simply by virtue of being Black or brown. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I am not sure how the court would come down on the issue of electronic surveillance. You know, it sort of raises a different set of questions than the Streif issue did, in part because justices on the Supreme Court can't conceive of themselves ever being in the position that Streif was in. They've probably never been stopped by the police in their lives. And yet, those members of the Supreme Court, those justices, likely do have cell phones and can conceive.
Clarence Thomas and Sonia Sotomayor maybe have been stopped by police.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe Clarence Thomas when he was a young man, probably not for many years.
Especially because he was a radical, too, I think. Sorry to interrupt you there.
Oh, he was? I didn't know that. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that it very well may be that some of those justices have a different view of electronic surveillance because they themselves could be subject to it. And that's a little depressing. But, you know, I don't want to speculate on what the court would or wouldn't do. Certainly, the next justice is going to have huge impact on the electronic privacy decisions that the court is going to make in coming years. You know, Scalia was really, really bad on lots of issues that the ACLU cares about, but on electronic privacy and Fourth Amendment issues more generally, he was one of the better justices on the court, actually. So
I just wanted to say very quickly that, you know, you mentioned, you referenced police terrorizing young people of color. I would just urge our listeners to read this Sotomayor dissent because she gets into great detail about how stop and frisk and police and arbitrary police detention really does terrorize people of color. And it's good reading. It's important reading.
Yes, and I guess if we're trying to figure out which way the Supreme Court's going to rule, it depends on who that ninth justice might be. And if it's someone like Merrick Garland, who's a very law and order type judge.
It's true. He was a former prosecutor.
Yeah, it might not bode well. I want to switch gears here real quick, Cade, and talk about the attack in Nice last week. And I want to play a clip that we played earlier in the show. This was Newt Gingrich just hours after the attack, and he's talking about what the U.S. needs to do to combat ISIS and other terrorist organizations online. Here's what he had to say.
Anybody who goes on a website favoring ISIS or Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, that should be a felony, and they should go to jail. Any organization which hosts such a website should be engaged in a felony. It should be closed down immediately.
Cade, your response to Newt Gingrich there?
Well, that sounds really crazy. It certainly sounds like Newt Gingrich is advocating explicitly unconstitutional government policy that would violate the First Amendment squarely. You know, there's been a lot of attention on these sort of unhinged comments that have come out of Newt Gingrich's mouth over the past couple days week as he's scrambled, I guess, to try to convince Donald Trump that he's the right guy for his vice presidential candidate. But the reality of government policy over the past 15 years is actually a lot closer to the kind of, you know, frankly, anti-constitutional, racist bile that Newt Gingrich is spewing. There's a guy here in Massachusetts called Tarek Mahana, who was railroaded by the federal government a number of years ago in a terrorism prosecution pursued by none other than Carmen Ortiz, who is infamous globally for prosecuting Aaron Swartz to the point where he killed himself. So before she had her run-in with Aaron Swartz, she went after Tarek Mahana, who was a pharmacy student in Massachusetts, Muslim guy, community leader, very involved in his mosque and socially. He was an anti-war activist when he was a teenager. He's about the same age as I am, actually, so it's sort of eerie to think about how our lives had such different trajectories, mostly because he's Muslim and I'm not. And, you know, we were doing a lot of the same things, frankly. I was protesting the war at the same time. We learned through his prosecution that the FBI had used a sneak and peek warrant to go inside of his house while his family was on vacation when he was 16 years old to install bugging equipment. So they had been looking at him for a long time. And ultimately, Carmen Ortiz charged him with material support for terrorism on the basis that he had translated some Al-Qaeda materials into English. Now, that is squarely First Amendment protected speech. And yet, because of a terrible Supreme Court precedent in a case that the Obama administration...
Holder v. Humanitarian Law?
Yeah, exactly. Because of Holder v. Humanitarian Law, there's really, really bad Supreme Court precedent that effectively carves out like a Muslim exemption to the First Amendment. So Tarek Mahana is serving decades in federal prison right now. He was convicted of material support for terrorism. He's been in solitary confinement ever since he was locked up a number of years ago. So, this notion that anyone who visits an ISIS or Al-Qaeda website, like Newt Gingrich is saying, should be charged with a felony is not actually so different from the ways in which the U.S. government is using existing law to go after Muslims who are expressing their First Amendment rights. There have been other cases where the FBI has charged people with simply retweeting ISIS accounts. I think you can probably find information about that just simply by looking it up on the internet. And, you know, so obviously...
Which might get you on a Newt Gingrich watch list. Look that up on
obviously
there.
Obviously, what he's saying is horrible, but you know, this is sort of this has been bothering me for a long time on a number of issues, right? Like Trump says all kinds of crazy stuff, like we're going to build a wall. Well, Hillary Clinton has also advocated, beefing up the so-called border security and the fence along the southwest border.
Right.
She basically supports building a wall too.
Just not as fancy of a wall as Donald Trump. Not as big and beautiful as he
exactly.
is.
Exactly. She's never said it's going to be beautiful. That's true.
Right.
But this is all of a piece, right? It's like Trump says something totally unhinged and all of the liberals and the left go, oh my God, that's so crazy. And yet, you know, President Obama has deported more people than any president in U.S. history.
Right.
He has overseen a drone assassination program where he's targeted U.S. citizens for extrajudicial murder, right?
The liberals seem to have a blind spot in their mind. But
selective outrage.
We're fresh out of time, Cade. We could... we could listen to you rant about this for another few hours. But thanks so much for coming on. Kate Crockford, the director of the Technology for Liberty program at the ACLU of Massachusetts, on Twitter at OneCade. Follow that account. It's good as hell. Thanks.
Bye, guys.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent, still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team. You can read all our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. Now let's go into a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
So you're not going to believe this, Sam, but Donald Trump, He created a bit of a stir.
Hold on a second. Let me lift my jaw up off the floor here.
Wow. That was impressive. After last week's attacks in Nice, he gave an interview calling for an immediate declaration of war. He said, if you look at this war coming from all different parts, he told Bill O'Reilly, and frankly, it's war, and we're dealing with people without uniforms. You know, in the old days, you would have uniforms. You knew who you were fighting, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is pretty dumb. If there's one thing we've seen from the past 15 years, it's that declaring war on terrorism generally makes it worse. But some of the liberal reaction to it was also rather vapid. Think Progress, for example, published a story with the headline, "Blaring, Trump jumps to conclusions minutes after Nice attack, says he would declare a world war as president." Well, most listeners of the show would know that's kind of already happening. And what's worse, it's happening without direct congressional oversight. The Obama administration is waging a global war against the Islamic State in Iraq, Syria, Libya, Cameroon, and Nigeria, and it is doing so by relying on legislation approving military operations, which was passed by Congress 3 days after 9/11. Colloquially, that legislation is known as the 2001 AUMF.
Which stands for Authorization for Use of Military Force, in case you didn't know.
Thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, just to briefly recap here, 2001 legislation, we're relying on that to declare war against an entity that did not exist in 2001.
Correct.
Just to bring out the absurdity a little more. And bringing it out a little more further, joining us to talk about it is journalist, activist, and author of several books, David Swanson. David, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Sam. And Sam, thanks for everything you're doing.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Well, I want to start by getting into this question about when is a war actually authorized by Congress and when is it not? Because it's at the center of a lawsuit against the administration right now. An army captain is suing the president, claiming that the war on the Islamic State is illegal since Congress never passed an AUMF directly naming the Islamic State. The administration filed a brief last week asking for this suit to be tossed out and claiming that Congress did actually approve of the ISIL war because they've funded the ISIL war. Where do you stand on this, David? Does funding a war equal congressional approval for a war?
Well, first of all, it's worth noting that under the Kellogg-Briand Pact, war is always illegal. And under the UN Charter, war is almost always illegal. And clearly that includes every single current U.S. and NATO and Western war. They're all illegal under treaties that the U.S. is party to. That being said, in the U.S., which thinks it can do whatever the heck it wants to the rest of the world, and international law be damned, the thinking is, well, if Congress approves of a war, then it's legal. And there have been many lawsuits of this sort, and as the Department of Justice response to this one notes, they have almost universally been rejected on the simple grounds that the courts have no business interfering with the affairs of the president and Congress. That is, war is a political matter to be left to the legislative and executive branches, and the courts should stay the heck out of it. Which, if, you know, U.S. culture gave a damn about adhering to treaties that the United States is party to, wouldn't make much sense because, you know, where else do you go but the judicial branch if the other two branches are blatantly violating the law and are, you know, collaborating in that action together? But, you know, that being a fantasy, the reality is that the U.S. District Court will very likely do what U.S. courts do and toss out the suit. But, you know, the 46-page response from the Justice Department contains numerous excuses and arguments, and we can go through as many as you want for why it should be rejected. And some make a lot more sense than others.
What's the worst hit, I should say, in those lists of reasons why the suit should be rejected?
Well, I think the most dangerous is when Obama says, as he always does, that he has both constitutional and statutory authority to wage whatever war he darn well pleases. You know, the actual text of the actual Constitution be damned, you know, because he doesn't have constitutional authority to do anything. The power to declare war rests with the Congress. The power to raise an army and fund a war and oversee a war rests with the Congress. I mean, that's the Constitution. So that's very, very dangerous. But just as blanket a check for a blank check for any wars are the claims that you simply cannot sue the U.S. government without the U.S. government's approval. And, you know, how often, which is called sovereign immunity, how often the U.S. government approves of having itself sued, I'm not sure. But also, you cannot sue a president for any sort of damages or penalty because courts are not allowed to impose anything whatsoever on a president. I mean, these sorts of arguments, which are, you know, the few pages at the very end, ought to have probably come first in the paper because they're so blanket and overwhelming. But, you know, it also does, as you say, bring up statutory authority, meaning the two authorizations for the use of military force, that from 2001 and that from 2003 on Iraq, which Obama notably did not end when he quote unquote ended that war that hasn't ended 5 years back or so. And the stretch is on the first one, where it's supposed to be about who was responsible for 9/11, which, as we've just seen in the past hour or so, was in large part Saudi Arabia. These 28 pages that it was, but who's responsible for 9/11? Well, the argument that the Justice Department makes is that, well, ISIS in Iraq was al-Qaeda. It's now split from al-Qaeda, but you cannot split from al-Qaeda. You maintain that identity in perpetuity and thereby retroactively are responsible for 9/11, and therefore war on you is authorized by this statute. You know, the case they make being that, well, a terrorist group could rename itself or divide itself and thereby you delegitimize our war against it. Never mind that that's not actually what happened here. So, you know, there's all kinds of stretches and excuses.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I remember at one point when Congress was actually debating an AUMF, an ISIS or ISIL-specific AUMF,
right?
Administration witnesses were bringing up these concerns like, oh, what if they change their name? And Congress people were just like, we're right here. We do this for a living, you know. You can just come back and ask for another AUMF, like as if Congress isn't going to approve war.
Well, and the problem with the Department of Justice's argument here by saying that just proving a funding for a war equals an authorization for that war is that you get no parameters around that war when you're just funding it. There's no geographic parameters. There's no duration, no types of organizations. Of course, the AUMF we usually get from the administration and passed by Congress doesn't include many of those parameters anyways, but funding has absolutely none of that usually included at all. So it will further erode the power of Congress, at least statutorily here in the U.S., to declare war, putting aside, of course, the international treaties you mentioned at the top that just make war legal to begin with.
Yeah. Well, of course, Congress hasn't actually declared a war since 1941, but it has done these vague and arguably unconstitutional authorizations of the president to declare war in certain circumstances as he sees fit, which is really what these things are. And the stretch in the Department of Justice's case is that if Congress has not explicitly cut off funding for a war, has not mandated the end to a war, well, then it has approved it. But if Congress has explicitly funded a war, well, then all the more so it really has approved and authorized and declared it. You know, that's the most reasonable case it makes, really, because if Congress is funding something and is refusing to cut off funding for something, then it you know, there's a case to be made that it really is authorizing it. But what Congress wants to do and has done for years now is avoid explicitly authorizing any of these wars while going ahead and letting them happen and funding them. And so in the same legislation, the newer legislation, not the AUMFs, but the recent legislation that's actually also cited in this argument, is language both funding a war on ISIS and language saying this must not be done, not $1, if it violates the War Powers Resolution. Which, of course, it does, you know, and so this is, you know, the War Powers Resolution is not, you know, common misperception notwithstanding, an authorization for a president to wage whatever wars he wants as long as he gives a report to Congress every 60 days, you know, as presidents and the media and many Congress members would like us to believe. The War Powers Resolution is in a crisis. When Congress is unavailable and Congress can't be asked, the president can start a war. He must give the Congress a report within 48 hours and end it within 60 days if Congress has not, in those 60 days, declared war or authorized it. You know, that's what the War Powers Resolution is. And these wars don't fit at all, but this is the, you know, and there was an effort in Congress in recent years to pass legislation to amend the War Powers Resolution to make it be just that the president has to send reports and can launch all the wars he wants, but that hasn't been passed, and so that's not what that law is.
The administration seems to be putting forward so much circular reasoning here that it's making my head hurt.
Or spin. Circular spin. I don't know. David, I wanted to turn quickly to the Bastille Day attack in Nice, France. French President François Hollande, actually in the middle of the night, he addressed the country a few hours after the attack, in the middle of the night, said he would ramp up strikes in Syria and Iraq. Here in the U.S., Newt Gingrich made he made a rather clunky appeal to increase bombing of the Islamic State. I just want to play it. Take a listen.
We should destroy them with kinetic power, using various weapons, starting with predators, and just, frankly, just killing them.
Just killing them.
Just killing them is what he said.
How does this kind of flawed approach keep surviving among U.S. policymakers, even though we've spent the last almost 20 years just trying to kill them?
I think because it's habit, it's ingrained in U.S. culture and U.S. media, because U.S. media organizations, unlike this one, which may have its own problems with a different government, are corrupted, are bought and paid for, and want to maintain access to corrupted officials and those in the pay of corrupted officials. And, you know, absolute lunatics like Newt Gingrich, people who have been themselves corrupted and totally wrong on everything for decades, are given voice. Newt Gingrich didn't just say, let's go kill people, unidentified people. He also said, let's interrogate every single person in the United States who might be Muslim and find out if they adhere to Sharia law, and if so, kick them out of the country.
And he also wants to make visiting certain websites illegal.
Yeah, well, is Fox News going to be one of them? Because, war propaganda is illegal under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and ought to be prosecuted along with Tony Blair and gang in a special tribunal that ought to go after Bush and Cheney and Obama more than any of their sidekicks across the ocean. But people like Newt Gingrich, who killed the peace dividend in 1989-90 because he was in the pay of Lockheed Martin, have no business proposing sets of questions to be asked of decent people in the United States. And if they get them wrong, kick them out of the country. And where do you send them, by the way? I mean, people like that need to be kept off the air and certainly out of consideration for, you know, nomination for public office.
I want to turn now to the 28 pages, because I noticed you had a lot to say about it on Twitter. What did you personally find most striking?
Well, I think the quantity of, I mean, it really is, it's not that repetitive. It really is 28 pages worth of pretty serious evidence. Whether it all holds up or not remains to be seen, but no doubt much of it will. Serious evidence of ties between top Saudi officials and the Saudi government and the Saudi royal family and the hijackers and the suspects of 9/11, including ties between people like Zubaydah and Bandar, you know, Bandar Bush, Bandar the ambassador, Bandar Bush's buddy.
Prince Bandar.
I mean, this is the story that was mocked by every respectable media outlet when Michael Moore put it in Fahrenheit 9/11, right? The Saudi ties to 9/11. Absolutely mocked, even in otherwise positive reviews of that movie. And this has been, you know, known and leaked out in bits and pieces here and there for months and months and actually years and years. And you know, what do people tell themselves now who believe, who try to believe that Bush actually thought Iraq had something to do with 9/11? You know, when he had this report, you know, all these years ago, this is a report from 2002. You know, this is from before the attack on Iraq, right? What do people tell themselves who try to believe the U.S. government means well about why this was censored? You know, and if there's a case to be made against all this apparently strong evidence, make it.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't this what Thomas Jefferson said? More free speech, not censorship.
What do you make of the claims at the beginning of the 28 pages that the CIA and the FBI, it wasn't even on their radar that there might be Saudi ties to terrorism in the U.S. because Saudi Arabia is an ally. Therefore, they weren't even considering the possibility. Do you buy that? Was that just a blind spot in the CIA or FBI because they genuinely believed there was no threat there? Or was this more actively like, let's not embarrass Saudi Arabia, let's not probe them too hard? There was just a hearing last week on Capitol Hill in which Congressman Steve Cohen blasted the administration, saying that Saudi Arabia should be on the state sponsor of terrorism list, and the reason why it's not is because we're slaves to their oil. So what do you make of that beginning part where the FBI and the CIA was just sort of ignoring any ties between Saudi Arabia and terrorism?
Well, I suspect it's fairly accurate that they were ignoring. As in terms of motivations, that's very hard to pull out. I mean, I almost have to get inside people's heads back in the past. I want to ask my friend Colleen Rowley, a FBI whistleblower from Minnesota, what she makes of it. But I think that more revealing is that at this point of this report in 2002, they're writing that they have themselves, that is Congress, chosen not to follow up on all these leads, but rather handed them off to the FBI and the CIA, which are both now energetically and vigorously pursuing them. Well, you know, here we are, this, you know, 14 years later almost, and what have we got? We've got just this report, finally, you know, after all these years and still with words blacked out in it, put before us. But where is the product of the CIA and FBI investigations that supposedly were underway in 2002?
Yeah, that's what I want to say.
Well, David, we hate never-ending war, but we could have a never-ending conversation with you about it. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, you can check out all of David's work at davidswanson.org. Also, his book, War is a Lie, just got re-released, the second edition. I encourage everybody to check out. It's a great book. David Swanson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. And subscribe to the show on iTunes by going to the District Sentinel radio channel. Stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.